abandon their homes, and seek shelter elsewhere. To the north, on the other side of a bridge across the Palmer River, was the home of the minister John Miles. Dispossessed residents began to flock to this large structure, which, after being reinforced against possible Indian attack, became known as the Miles Garrison. A few miles to the east, in Mattapoisett, there was also the Bourne Garrison, a large stone structure that soon contained 16 men and 54 women and children. On the morning of Sunday, June 20th, 7 or 8 Indians approached an inhabitant of Kikemuit who had not yet abandoned his home. The Indians asked if they could use his grinding stone to sharpen one of their hatchets. The man told them that since it was the Sabbath, his God would be very angry if he should let them do it. Soon after, the Indians came across an Englishman walking up the road. They stopped him and said he should not work on his God's day and that he should tell no lies. Unnerved and intimidated, the last residents of Kikemuit left for the shelter of the garrisons. By day's end, 2 houses had been burned to the ground. Governor Winslow received word of the vandalism that night, and by the morning of Monday, June 21st, he had ordered towns across the colony to muster their militia for a rendezvous at Taunton, where they would be dispatched to Swansea. He also sent a message to officials in Boston requesting their colony's assistance. There was no reason to assume that Massachusetts Bay would rush to Plymouth's defense. As the flare-up with Philip in 1671 had shown, there were many in that colony who were critical of Plymouth's treatment of the Poconokets. And for those with long memories, Plymouth had been so slow to come to the Bay Colony's aid during the Pequot War that the Plymouth militia had missed the fighting. In the end, however, Massachusetts Bay decided that it was in their own best interests to support Plymouth. Not only was the uprising a possible threat to its inhabitants, but the conflict might make available large portions of choice Indian land. In the middle of all this, Governor Winslow decided he needed to put his colony's religious house in order. The latest troubles with the Indians were a sign that God was unhappy with Plymouth. It was time, therefore, that we humble ourselves before the Lord for all those sins whereby we have provoked our good God sadly to interrupt our peace and comfort. Winslow proclaimed that Thursday, June 24th, be designated a day of fasting and humiliation. Plymouth Colony was rife with sin, but apparently none of those sins involved the treatment of the Indians. Winslow later insisted that we stand as innocent as it is possible for any person or people towards their neighbor. Even the trial for Sassaman's murder was, in Winslow's view, an example of English justice and magnanimity. In a letter to the governor of Connecticut, he claimed that Tobias and the other condemned men had given us thanks for our fair trial of them. The result of this stubborn insistence on rectitude was to dehumanize the Indians so that they seemed the wanton and senseless instruments of God's will. This meant that there was nothing to be achieved through diplomacy. If the English were to make any progress in their difficulties with the Indians, they must do it through prayer and the sword. By Monday night, companies of militiamen had begun to arrive at Taunton. The elderly James Cudworth of Scituate was designated the army's commander with Major William Bradford, the 55-year-old son of the former governor, as his immediate subordinate. Since they'd just arrived on the scene, Cudworth and Bradford were as ignorant as everyone else as to the movements of the Poconokets. There was one man, however, who had first-hand knowledge of the territory to the south and the Indians surrounding Mount Hope Bay. Just the year before, Benjamin Church, a 33-year-old carpenter, had become the first Englishman to settle in the southeastern tip of Narragansett Bay at a place called Seconnet, home to the female sachem Awashonks and several hundred of her people. Instead of being intimidated by the fact that he was the only Englishman in Seconnet, known today as Little Compton, Rhode Island, Church relished the chance to start from scratch. "My head and hands were full about settling a new plantation," he later remembered, "where nothing was brought to, no preparation of dwelling house or outhousing or fencing made. horses and cattle were to be provided, ground to be cleared and broken up, and the uttermost caution to be used to keep myself free from offending my Indian neighbors all round me. Church was a throwback to his maternal grandfather, Mayflower passenger Richard Warren. By moving to Sakonnet, he was leaving his past behind and beginning anew in Indian country. But as became increasingly clear in the traumatic months ahead, Church had moved well beyond his pilgrim forebears. The early days of Plymouth Colony had been devoted to establishing a community of fellow worshippers. Within the shelter of their wooden wall, the pilgrims had done their best to separate themselves from both the wilderness and the ungodly. Church, on the other hand, was quite content to be living among the heathen, both red and white. In addition to Awashanks and the Sakonnets, with whom he developed a good acquaintance, and was in a little time in great esteem among them, there were the residents of Aquidneck Island, just across the Sakonnet River to the west. Mostly Baptists and Quakers, these were not the sorts with whom a proper Puritan socialized. Church, on the other hand, found the gentlemen of the island very civil and obliging. While his wife Alice and their 2-year-old son Thomas stayed with relatives in Duxbury, he labored to prepare a new home for them. Church had taken up where the former Lord of Misrule, Thomas Morton of Merrymount, had left off 50 years before. But where Morton had been an outsider from the start, Church was as closely connected by blood and by marriage. His wife was the daughter of Constant Southworth, William Bradford's stepson, to the aristocracy of Plymouth Colony, as it was possible to be. He was also ambitious. Possessed of uncommon activity and industry, he had already constructed 2 buildings by the spring of 1675, when he heard a disturbing rumor. Philip, sachem of Mount Hope, just 5 miles to the north, was plotting a bloody design. From the start, Church had known that his future at Sakonnet depended on a strong relationship with sachem Awashanks, and over the course of the last year, the two had become good friends. In early June, she sent him an urgent message. Philip was about to go to war, and he demanded that the Sakonnets join him. Before she made her decision, Awashanks wanted to speak with Church. Church quickly discovered that 6 of Philip's warriors had come to Sakonnet. Awashanks explained that they had threatened to incite the wrath of the Plymouth authorities against her by attacking the English houses and livestock on her side of the river. She would then have no alternative but to join Philip. Church turned to the Poconokets and accused them of being bloody wretches who thirsted after the blood of their English neighbors who had never injured them. For his part, he hoped for peace, but if war should erupt, he vowed to be a sharp thorn in their sides. He recommended that Awashanks look to the colony for protection from the Poconokets. He promised to leave immediately for Plymouth and return as soon as possible with instructions from the governor. Just to the north of the Sakonnets, in modern Tiverton, Rhode Island, were the Pocassets, led by another female sachem, Weetamoo. Even though she was Philip's sister-in-law, the relationship did not necessarily guarantee that she was inclined to join forces with him. Church decided to stop at Pocasset on his way to Winslow's home in Duxbury. He found her, alone and despondent, on a hill overlooking Mount Hope Bay. She had just returned by canoe from Philip's village. War, Weetamoo feared, was inevitable. Her own warriors were all gone against her will to the dances at Mount Hope. Church advised her to go immediately to Aquidneck Island, just a short canoe ride away, for her safety. As he had told Awashanks, he promised to return in just a few days with word from Governor Winslow. But Church never got the chance to make good on his promise. Before he could return to Weetamoo and Awashanks, the fighting had begun. Church had been in Plymouth speaking with Governor Bradford when the call for the militia had gone out, and he had immediately reported to Taunton. As the army prepared to march to Swansea, Major Bradford requested that Church lead the way with a small vanguard of soldiers. Church and his company, which included several friend Indians, moved so quickly over the path to Swansea that they were able to kill, roast, and eat a deer before the main body of troops caught up with them. Church was already discovering that he enjoyed the life of a soldier. As he later wrote in a book about his experiences during the war, "I was spirited for that work." But the impetuous Church still had much to learn about military tactics. His mission had been to provide protection to the soldiers behind him. By sprinting to Swansea, he had left the army vulnerable to an Indian ambush. While Church crowed about the speed of his march south, his commanding officers may have begun to realize that this was a soldier whose ambition and zeal verged on recklessness. Over the next few days, more and more soldiers arrived at Swansea. In addition to fortifying the Miles garrison, a temporary barricade was constructed to provide the growing number of soldiers with protection from possible attack. But no direct action was taken against the Indians. Given that hundreds of native warriors were said to have rallied around Philip, Cudworth felt that his own force must more than match the Indians before they marched on Mount Hope. With each passing day, the outrages committed by the Indians increased. Church and his compatriots could hear their whoops and the crackle of gunfire as the native warriors slaughtered cattle and pilfered houses. But so far, no English men or women had been injured. By the morning of Wednesday, June 23rd, some residents had grown bold enough to return to their houses to retrieve goods and provisions. That morning, a father and son ventured from the garrison and came upon a group of Indians ransacking several houses. The boy had a musket, and his father urged him to fire on the looters. One of the Indians fell, then picked himself up and ran away. Later in the day, some Indians approached the garrison and asked why the boy had shot at one of their men. The English responded by asking whether the Indian was dead. When the Indians replied in the affirmative, the boy snidely said it was no matter. The soldiers tried to calm the now infuriated Indians by saying it was but an idle lad's word. But the truth of the matter was that the boy had given the warriors exactly what they wanted, the go-ahead to kill. Thursday, June 24th, the day of fasting and humiliation throughout the colony, proved momentous in the history of Plymouth, but not in the way the governor had intended. Reports differ, but all agree that it was a day of horror and death in Swansea. At least 10 people, including the boy and his father, were killed by the Indians. Some were killed on their way back from prayers at the meeting house. One couple and their 20-year-old son stopped at their home to secure some provisions. The father told his wife and son to return to the garrison while he finished collecting corn. But as the father left the house, he was beset by Indians and killed. Hearing gunshots, the son and his mother returned to the house. Both were attacked, and in what became a common fate in the months ahead, scalped. And as also happened with terrifying frequency, both survived their scalpings, only to die from loss of blood. For Church and the other soldiers cooped up at the garrison, the days ahead proved an exasperating and humiliating ordeal as they were forced to wait for the reinforcements from Massachusetts Bay to arrive. In a clear attempt to mock the soldiers' impotence, the Indians had the audacity to approach the garrison itself. Two soldiers sent to draw a bucket of water from a nearby well were shot and carried away. They were later discovered with their fingers and feet cut off and the skin of their heads flayed off. Even worse, the Indians succeeded in killing two of the garrison's own sentries under the very noses of most of our forces. On the night of June 26th, a total eclipse of the moon was witnessed all across New England. Several soldiers claimed they saw a black spot in the moon's center resembling the scalp of an Indian. All agreed that an eclipse falling out at that instant of time was ominous. Finally, on Monday, June 28th, with the arrival of several Massachusetts companies from Boston, the number of soldiers had reached the point that Cudworth was willing to venture from the garrison. In addition to a troop of horse under Captain Thomas Prentice and a company of foot soldiers under Captain Daniel Henchman, there was a rowdy bunch of volunteers under the command of Captain Samuel Moseley. The English had not yet fought a single battle, but Moseley, a sea captain, was already something of a hero. In April, Moseley had led a successful assault on some Dutch privateers off the coast of Maine. In June, several of the captured sailors were put on trial and condemned to death. But with the outbreak of war, they were granted a reprieve as long as they were willing to fight the Indians under Moseley. In addition to this multinational group of pirates, which included a huge Dutchman named Cornelius Anderson, Moseley secured the services of a wild gang of servants and apprentices from Boston. Decidedly lacking in Puritan restraint, and with a seaman's love of profanity, Moseley's company proved adept at transferring their talent for murder and mayhem from the wilderness of the high seas to the swamps and forests of New England. To a pious group of farm boys and merchants, Moseley's men seemed as savage as the Indians themselves. To Benjamin Church, who had suddenly been superseded as one of the army's more colorful and audacious figures, Moseley was destined to become both a rival and a nemesis. With the arrival of more than 300 new soldiers, the Miles garrison quickly became charged with a crude and volatile energy. The assault was scheduled for the following day, but some of the new arrivals, led by quartermasters John Gill and Andrew Belcher, requested liberty to go out immediately and seek the enemy in their own quarters. Some Indians on the opposite side of the river were taking great delight in firing on the garrison. It was time to put these heathens in their place. Permission was granted, and 12 troopers prepared to take it to the enemy. In addition to William Hammond of nearby Rehoboth, who was to act as their pilot or scout, the troopers requested the services of Benjamin Church. They quickly set out across the bridge, all of them knowing that an audience of several hundred English soldiers was watching their every move. Almost as soon as they crossed the bridge, about a dozen Indians concealed in some nearby bushes let loose a killing volley of shot. In an instant, Hammond, the scout, was, if not dead, nearly so. Belcher was hit in the knee and his horse was shot out from under him, while Gill was slammed in the gut. Fortunately, he'd worn a protective coat of quarter-inch thick oxhide known as a buff coat, which he had lined with several pieces of well-placed parchment and had suffered only a severe bruise. The troopers were so terrified by the attack that they turned their horses around and galloped back for the garrison, leaving Hammond dazed and dying in the saddle and Belcher pinned beneath his horse. As the troopers clattered across the bridge, Church stormed and stamped and told them 'twas a shame to run and leave a wounded man there to become a prey to the barbarous enemy. By this time, Hammond had fallen down dead off his horse, and with the assistance of Gill and only one other man, Church attempted to save Belcher's life. Church jumped off his horse and loaded both Belcher and Hammond onto the horses of the other two. As they retreated to the garrison, Church went after Hammond's horse, which was wandering off toward the Indians. All the while, he shouted out to those at the garrison to come over and fight the enemy. But no one appeared willing to join him. The Indians had had a chance to reload and were now blasting away at Church as he continued to bawl indignantly at the army on the other side of the river. Every one of the Indians' bullets missed its mark, although one ball did strike the foot of a soldier watching from the safety of the garrison. Church decided he had better join his cowardly compatriots before the Indians had a chance to reload and fire once again. He started back across the bridge, but not without proclaiming, "The Lord have mercy on us if such a handful of Indians shall thus dare such an army." It was a grim and awful night. The weather had deteriorated dramatically since they'd seen the lunar eclipse several nights before, and as a cold wind lashed the Miles garrison with rain and Moseley's roughneck crew mocked the troopers with many profane oaths, a soldier from Watertown lost control of himself, screaming, "God is against the English." He ran crazily around the garrison until he was finally subdued. A lamentable spectacle. The vast majority of the soldiers gathered that night had grown up on stories of the military might of the Puritans during the English Civil War. One of the most efficient fighting forces of the age, Cromwell's New Model Army had subdued England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. The navy